what is this last day of unleavened bread all about? I asked some people this question and got varying answers, but what events, what important events in the Bible happened on this last day of unleavened bread? A lot of times we don't think about it. But there are historic events that illustrate the objective in the redemption process. The Apostle Paul saw something that was insightful, and I don't know that we would have thought about this day except for what he wrote, and it's in 1 Corinthians 10, in verse 6. A number of things happened to the children of Israel as they were leaving Egypt and throughout the next 4 decades. And Paul said, speaking of these things, he said, these things were our examples to the intent that we should not lust after evil things as they also lusted. He's illustrating the things that they experienced, the things that they made mistakes in, and the things that they did in those years. It says in verse 7, neither be idolaters, as were some of them, as it is written, the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play. Neither let us commit fornication, as some of them committed, and fell in one day 23,000. They made mistakes along the way. Neither let us tempt Christ, as some of them also tempted, and were destroyed of serpents. Neither murmur you, as some of them also murmured, and were destroyed of the destroyer. Paul is illustrating the things that happened with those people. Now we might have thought, oh, this is the righteous nation. God is bringing them out of Egypt. And they would have had their thinking straight as to what was going on. But it turns out they didn't. They exhibited many of the characteristics of carnal human nature, which is one of the things that we associate with being leavened with a sinful nature. In verse 11, Paul is especially insightful. He says, now all of these things happened unto them for examples, and they are written for our admonition, upon whom the ends of the world are come. Paul is telling us that the examples of the people being brought out of Egypt, being delayed for 40 years in the wilderness, are more relevant to us than it was to them. Why? Because we are being called. They weren't necessarily. But the experiences that they had were illustrations of the process. And it's the process we need to be thinking about. What happens on this seventh day of unleavened bread in history that are worth our notice and are worth us observing as we conclude these 7 days? The days of unleavened bread picture aspects of our salvation process. The Exodus experience also did. The Exodus experience illustrates the main course of our calling, if we see the illustrations that are contained within it. It's just the first 7 days of the Exodus that were unleavened. We read of that in Exodus chapter 23. And it's in verse 15, Exodus 23:15. He says, you shall keep the feast of unleavened bread. You shall eat unleavened bread 7 days, as I commanded you in the time appointed of the month of Abib, for in it you came out from Egypt, and none shall appear before me empty. Now, one thing that the unleavened situation shows us, number one, is they didn't plan to go out of Egypt unleavened. Unleavened. If they had known that they were going to be leaving the next morning, wouldn't they have prepared some food? The fact that they didn't prepare any bread for the road tells us they didn't expect to be leaving that suddenly. Paul also explains something interesting, and I don't know that we would have thought of this except for the fact he says it. Back to 1 Corinthians 10. Moreover, brethren, I would not that you should be ignorant how that all our fathers were under the cloud and all passed through the sea. And all were baptized unto Moses in the cloud and in the sea. And did all eat that same spiritual meat. And all did drink the same spiritual food, for they drank of that spiritual rock that followed them. And that rock was Christ. Paul equates their being under the cloud and passing through the sea as the baptismal experience, the baptism of the nation. It may not be baptism in the sense that we would think of it today, but it illustrated God's plan, part of God's plan. And I think it's interesting to notice that they didn't pass through the Red Sea until the last day of unleavened bread. That's one of the things that happened on this day. Israel, as a nation, was baptized into the purpose that God had for that nation, picturing the conversion process. Not saying they were converted. But in our case, that's what it's talking about. But Paul also said that they were baptized under the cloud as well as passing through the Red Sea. I'm going to speculate here and just point out something that I think is valid. That when God brought them out of Egypt, He sanctified them. And He put them under this cloud of baptism before the actual baptism that conveyed them through to the end of this 7-day process. This 7-day process pictures, of course, putting sin out of our lives. They had to commit themselves to that when they left Egypt. When they got on the road, they committed themselves to a point of no return. But they weren't baptized yet. But being under the cloud, I believe, was preliminary to their baptism. God was working with them. He had sanctified them. He's bringing them to a point. And does the same thing apply to us? When we're first called, we're not baptized immediately. There is a period of time when we are under that cloud of sanctification, brought to the point in time when we're actually baptized. Just something to think about. Now, we know that God's Spirit works with people before they are baptized. Before they make the covenant of baptism. So I think that that's what Paul saw when he said that. And that's why he said they were baptized under the cloud and through the sea. Is there a comparison there? I'll leave that for your own determination, but I think there was. How do we know that it was the last day of unleavened bread when they passed through the sea? In Exodus 13:21 and 22, it tells us something. And this is a big question to anyone who's done something like this. If you've ever had a multi-day wilderness trek, you have to wonder, when did those people rest? Exodus 13, what did I say? 13:21. And the Lord went before them by day in a pillar of a cloud to lead them the way, and by night in a pillar of fire to give them light, to go by day and night. They walked continually. Did they walk continually for 6 full days? He took not away the pillar of the cloud by day nor the pillar of fire by night from before the people. How did they do that? How far was it from their starting point to the shores of the Red Sea before they crossed? They had 6 days to get there. Well, it was 180 miles. And doing about 30 miles a day, it was possible. But think about it, that is grueling. How on earth could they march day and night? I'm going to suggest that this is how they did it. Now, we know that they went out of Egypt organized. They were probably organized by tribes. What I'm thinking is, what happened is, when the tribes were all moving, after a certain point of time, well, let's say 8 or 10 hours, the first tribe stopped and stepped aside on the trail, and the rest of the tribes continued on by them. When the second tribe got ahead of the first tribe, they did the same thing. They stepped aside and let the rest of the column go on by. And so on and so on in each of the tribes. As the last tribe passed, the first tribe took their place and stepped back in line, and then the second tribe behind them, and so on. It was sort of a rotational thing. That gave them time to eat, to rest, to sleep, and yet the whole column kept moving continually, day and night. Now, next question is, how long would it take the rest of the tribes to pass by each of the tribes when they stopped? There is a way that we can know that. I'm going to tell you it was roughly 8 hours. How do we know it was roughly 8 hours? When they came to the shores of the Red Sea, it was just about dusk, the end of day 6, the beginning of day 7. Now, in our irrigation system, we have a thing called a weir. It's a choke point in the canal. And the dimensions of the weir and the depth of water in the weir tells us how much water is passing that point. The Red Sea itself acted something like a weir. We know the distance across, and we know the time across. So from those two factors, we can estimate the size of the congregation and how long it took for the whole mass of people to pass by a certain point. It's roughly 8 miles across where they crossed over. And we know that they left as the seventh day was beginning at dusk. And we know they were on the opposite shore looking back at sunrise the next morning. So it was about 12 hours for the whole congregation to pass through. Now, considering the circumstances, I think they would have moved a little faster than normal to get to the end of the sixth day, to get to the end of their 180 miles. They would have had to travel, the whole mass of people would have to travel about 1.25 miles per hour. That's not too bad. When we were hiking in the mountains back east on Mount Washington, we would go up, 3,000 or 4,000 feet from the base to the top and back down. And it was a 7 mile round trip, and it takes about 7 hours. So 1 mile an hour is not bad. And this is even in a rugged hike with a backpack and up and down. They were pretty much on the flat. So 1.25 miles per hour is not really unrealistic. But they crossed over the Red Sea as it was beginning to dawn on day 7. This was the last day of unleavened bread. And they looked back and they saw dead bodies floating in the water. Now that tells us something. That the Egyptian army was right behind them. They were fully in the waters themselves. As Israel was climbing up the bank out of the water and turning around looking back, that's when the water collapsed. The huge concussion of hundreds of feet of water falling in on them. No one survived that. But they saw the bodies. And to see the bodies on the east shore against the wind tells you they were really close. What kept them apart? Another spiritual illustration. What kept them apart? The pillar of cloud and the pillar of fire. But you'll find there's a scripture, and we'll maybe cover this at one of our upcoming Bible studies. But the Lord was in the pillar of fire. The angel of the Lord, it said, stood between Israel and Egypt and kept them apart all night, which tells us both columns were moving. So it wasn't just the pillar of cloud and the pillar of fire. That was the visible aspect of it. But the Lord was in it. And what happened to that cloud? What happened to that pillar of fire? After the crossing? That's another interesting story. But that's for Bible study. But it stayed with them. Clear up until the point in time when they crossed the Jordan River into the Promised Land. But those people were on the quest for the promise that was made to Abraham. They knew where they were going. And all of the complaints that they had, you never heard a complaint, where on earth are we going? They knew where they were going. They knew what the promise was. They knew what the promised land was. That was always in their mind. The promise. Now God has left us the same promise. The promise he made to Abraham. And we've talked about the four succeeding phases of the promise made to Abraham. We're in one of those phases. And Paul said, if you become Christ's seed, then are you Abraham's seed and heirs according to the promise. We have the same promise that they had, but it was in the spiritual dimension. Theirs was in the physical dimension at that time. Now, the fulfillment of that promise with us, of course, is going to be a reality also of God's literal kingdom here on earth, a government that we're going to be a part of. So we have a promise to look forward to. There's an interesting passage in Joshua 5. And it's in verse 13. It says, and it came to pass, when Joshua was over by Jericho, that he lifted up his eyes and looked, and behold, there stood a man over against him with his sword drawn in his hand. And Joshua had the courage to go over to him and said, who are you? Are you for us? Or are you here for our enemies? And this being answered, and he says, no, but as the captain of the host of the Lord am I now come. And Joshua fell on his face to the earth and did worship, and said unto him, What saith my Lord unto his servant? And the answer was very unexpected. The captain of the Lord's host said unto Joshua, Loose thy shoes from off your feet, for the place whereon you stand is holy. My feeling is, and it's like we know it's in that same general area, where the promise to Abraham was made. Was Joshua at that very spot 430 years later? Now, this would have been the first day of unleavened bread. This was before they ate of the produce of the land. This was before the 7 days of encirclements around Jericho. But Joshua was over in a certain place by himself. And he met this angel of the Lord. And the place was declared to be holy ground. What else could it be? Any ideas? That would be my thought. Very likely, Joshua was in that very place where the Abrahamic covenant had been made. Profound. But that was the first day of unleavened bread, early in the morning. After that, they began the 7 day encirclements of Jericho. And we know what happened on the seventh day. They circled the city 7 times. And the trumpets were blown. And the walls collapsed outward. And they rushed in and killed every living thing in the city and burned everything that was there, according to God's instructions. So what happened on this other event, this other last day of unleavened bread, at the end of the Exodus period, keep in mind the baptism through the Red Sea occurred at the beginning of the Exodus period, but bracketing that on the last was the destruction of Jericho. Destroying the thing that prevented them or that stood in the way for them to receive the promise. Jericho had to go, as well as all the other cities in the region. God gave them that land by promise. It was His decision how to handle it. Granted, it wasn't necessarily a pleasant experience, but to conquer those things that prevent us from accessing God's full promise sometimes takes a little grit, takes a little determination. In Exodus 23, I'm thinking that this may be also that same angel that Joshua encountered. Exodus 23. And you have to wonder why it wouldn't be. Verse 20. And keep the cloud in mind, because we know the angel of the Lord was in the cloud. There's many scriptures that mention that. But here in verse 20, Exodus 23, verse 20, Behold, I send an angel before you to keep you in the way and to bring you unto the place which I have prepared. Beware of him and obey his voice. Provoke him not, for he will not pardon your transgressions. For my name is in him. I'm thinking that this angel here, at the beginning, was the same one that Joshua encountered over near Jericho 40 years later. I'm open to a better answer, but that's my feeling. But it tells us something about that angel. It was directing their steps. It was leading them. And Paul says something more about that. 1 Corinthians 10:4. And all did drink that same spiritual drink, for they drank of that spiritual rock that followed them. And that rock was Christ. I'm thinking about that angel of the Lord. I had someone write to me this week, and she had done a study on the angel of the Lord, and she showed that many times it was a euphemism for Christ himself. Maybe Paul realized that. But that rock that followed them, that directed them, that brought them to where he wanted them to be, Paul is saying that was Christ, or a direct representative of himself. So we have major events here. We have the crossing of the Red Sea. We had the Exodus itself. We had the establishment of the tabernacle within the first year. They stopped at Mount Sinai until the second year before they moved again. We can read of that. And at the time that the tabernacle was established, the pillar of cloud took residence over the tabernacle, at times in front of the tabernacle, and at times within it, to the point where no one could go in without specifically being called in. And that pillar of cloud oftentimes exhibited itself as a pillar of flame all through the 40 years. And you have to wonder, how could those people, seeing that, eating manna every day for 40 years, how could they fall away? How could they doubt God's presence? How could they fail to listen carefully to what he's saying? And you have to think about it. There's many situations in our religious experience where people who have heard the truth, who have embraced the truth, and at first couldn't get enough of the truth, we used to drive 100 and some miles to Bible study every week back in Boston. How many people drove for hours to get to church and wouldn't miss a week? And yet, when doubts came, or when they got tired, they acted just like these people that Paul describes. They lost it. Somehow, something wasn't there. And I think that is a parallel to our experience. Yes, baptism brings us to a point, but that's not the destination. We're not fully there. That's merely the beginning. That's the commitment to continue the remainder of the 40 years to fill out that generation. See the point? See the parallel? There's many, many parallels. Paul again. Now all of these happened unto them for an example, and they are written for our admonition, upon whom the ends of the world are come. Wherefore, let him that thinks he stands take heed lest he fall. Many of them did. There has no temptation taken you, but such as is common to man. But God is faithful. He will not allow you to be tempted above that you are able, but will with the temptation also make a way to escape, that you may be able to bear it. We are dealing with another Pharaoh, not the same one that they dealt with. We have one also. If we're not careful, he can pursue us and conquer us and take us back. We know that. We've seen it. We've seen it happen with other people. These days of unleavened bread are a reminder that we are still facing our wilderness years. We've got to finish the course. We've got to pass all the way through to the end. Hopefully these days, hopefully this experience of focusing once again on ridding ourselves of those pesky, persistent sins is useful in that quest to receive the promise that God gave through Abraham to his people.